how is he arguing against Roosevelt? What are the key things he's pointing out?
America became great by minding its own affairs, and America will stay great by minding its own affairs. How's that for a bumper sticker?
That's great. This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and anyone interested in history, featuring the minds and voices of the University of Texas at Austin. In the late 1930s, Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia gave the prospect of war in Europe an air of inevitability. Across the Atlantic, a fierce debate was underway. Should America get involved or stay out? On one side of the debate was President Franklin Roosevelt, who favored intervention. And on the other, Charles Lindbergh, the most famous aviator of his day, the son of a congressman, and the de facto spokesperson for the America First Committee. Our guest today is UT Professor H.W. Brandt, whose new book, America First, Roosevelt vs. Lindbergh in the Shadow of War, not only narrates the debate between these two camps, it sheds light on how the interventionist consensus, in place more or less since Pearl Harbor, is under threat today in ways that it hasn't been for decades. Professor Brandt, welcome to 15 Minute History.
My pleasure.
I would think the best place to start here is to assume our listeners have an understanding of who Franklin Roosevelt was, but not perhaps so much Charles Lindbergh. Could you tell us a little bit about the other protagonist in your story here?
Yeah, so I set my story up as a debate between Franklin Roosevelt and Charles Lindbergh. Roosevelt's an obvious part of this duo because he's president of the United States, and everybody knew him then, everybody knows him now. Charles Lindbergh was as famous in his day as Franklin Roosevelt. Charles Lindbergh was certainly more famous than Franklin Roosevelt at the beginning of Roosevelt's presidency. This because Lindbergh became a national hero, indeed something of a world hero, by accomplishing the feat of flying across the Atlantic solo in 1927. This is something that flyers, engineers had been trying to accomplish for some years. There was a large cash prize for the first one to do it. And Lindbergh did it. Lindbergh was to the 1920s and 1930s what American astronauts were to the country in the 1960s. He's kind of an odd partner or rival to Roosevelt in this debate over what's the future of the United States, what should America's role in the world be. Odd in the sense that he's not an elected official, he's not president of the United States, certainly, but he does have this visibility. And so the pairing, although odd at first, Roosevelt against Lindbergh, it actually works out for my purpose, and it works out in terms of articulating these opposing positions. In favor of intervention, this is Roosevelt. Opposed to intervention, this is Lindbergh.
So he comes from this sort of isolationist background.
I'll agree with that up to a point, except I'm going to have to take issue with the term that you used, isolationist.
Yeah.
Because it certainly was not a term that was accepted by those people who were called isolationists. It was a term of opprobrium almost from the beginning. And Lindbergh would have said, it's not as though we should ignore what happens in the world. What we should do, indeed, is to enhance American defenses against external attack. But instead of declaring that our frontier is on the Rhine River in the middle of Europe, we should make our frontier 200 miles off the coast of North America. That we can defend. That we can defend without damage to American institutions and values. And he claimed that this was the position that the United States had adopted from the time of George Washington until then, with the one big exception of the First World War. An exception, by the way, that Americans overwhelmingly had retrospectively rejected. By the mid-1920s, and certainly through the mid-1930s, Americans, almost to a person, said that American intervention in the First World War had been a mistake. And it was a mistake that should not be repeated, to the point where Congress passed a series of laws, the neutrality laws, that said the United States will not get involved in any foreign war. And in fact, forbade the president from doing the kind of things that Woodrow Wilson had done incrementally to get the United States into World War I.
Did Lindbergh have political ambitions himself? Did he want to be a congressman, a senator, president one day?
Almost from the time Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic and then got back to the United States, People connected to political parties said you'd make a great candidate for Congress, make a candidate for governor, a great candidate for president. He resisted them time and again. His father had been a member of Congress during the decade of World War I and had opposed American participation in the war. For that position, he had been tracked by that era's version of the FBI. He had run afoul of the Sedition Act, and he'd been driven out of politics. And Lindbergh wanted nothing to do with politics as a result of this. So during the 1930s, even in the early 1940s, it was proposed to Lindbergh that he should perhaps challenge Franklin Roosevelt for president in 1940. He probably could have gotten the nomination of the Republican Party almost for the asking, but every time he was asked, he refused.
You paint a picture in one scene of Lindbergh speaking in New York, and there's a large crowd outside and there's hushed silence inside as he speaks. But there's also a radio broadcast. And so what role is radio playing in this sort of duking it out between these two ideas?
Radio is what made the debate between Roosevelt and Lindbergh a national event. They never actually stood on the same stage debating each other. But radio conveyed their message to the country at large. Roosevelt was on the radio in his fireside chats. These were the semi-informal broadcasts from the White House. Also, when he would give a speech before Congress. So Roosevelt had no problem commanding the airwaves. And this was the way people got news in real time. I should add that these radio broadcasts were such a big deal that major newspapers around the country would publish the transcripts verbatim. So if you didn't hear the radio address last night, you can read every word that Franklin Roosevelt said. And they would devote pages and pages to this sort of thing. They weren't giving an elevator pitch. They weren't aiming for a soundbite, but they did know, of course, that they would be excerpted, they would be quoted. So they were certainly looking for memorable lines.
Is this a fair fight? Is this a foregone conclusion? Do they stick to the tenets of their debate?
They weren't treating it as a debate, as an exercise in rhetoric. This is a political effort. And Roosevelt would win if he got the United States involved in the war. Lindbergh would win if the United States did not get involved. Roosevelt was a modestly adept public speaker. But what he was really good at were press conferences.
All right.
And the press conferences were not broadcast. However, they were reported by the reporters there. But on Roosevelt's terms. So in those days, a press conference, again, was not recorded, was not broadcast. The president could be quoted only with his direct permission. And so on numerous occasions, Roosevelt would say something, reporters would say, can we quote you on that? No or yes. And so Roosevelt could set the terms of the discussion. Lindbergh surprised me by being good at drafting, composing a political argument. So his arguments held together. They would not be effective today, I would say, because the attention span for political rhetoric today is simply shorter. Roosevelt had resources, had powers that Lindbergh couldn't even touch. However, Roosevelt began far behind Lindbergh because on the outbreak of war, the beginning of September 1939, American public opinion was overwhelmingly against American involvement in the war. So there were plenty of people who by September of 39 were willing to say, Hitler's a bad guy, the Nazis are in the wrong. But there were some who said, well, the British have brought some of this on themselves. I mean, starting with the fact that it was the British and the French who declared war on Germany, not the other way around. The British and the French had given a guarantee to Poland, but as Lindbergh liked to point out, that was a foolish guarantee in that you can't guarantee it. And if the Germans should call your bluff, how are you going to attack Germany? So Roosevelt is starting from this disadvantage. Americans don't want to go to war. Roosevelt was convinced that American troops were going to go, that Germany would be defeated only by an American army. And furthermore, that's a good thing because Roosevelt had concluded that the United States needs to take this leading role in world affairs. Here's our chance. And through all of this, Lindbergh is saying every time Roosevelt said that this is going to actually make it less likely to go to war, Lindbergh would say, he usually didn't say Roosevelt is lying, but what he said was Roosevelt knows better. And he's not telling the truth. And Every time there would be another step, and Lindbergh would say, well, this is going to lead to another step, and then it would be another step. Until on the eve of the 1940 election, in which Roosevelt is running for an unprecedented third term, breaking all the de facto rules against third terms. And on the eve of the election, Roosevelt says, I'm not going to be sending American soldiers to fight in any foreign wars. And Lindbergh knew that Roosevelt wasn't telling the truth. Roosevelt knew that Roosevelt wasn't telling the truth. In fact, this came out when Roosevelt's adult son, Jimmy, asked his dad about this. He said, Dad, how could you say that? You know we're going to war. He said, Jimmy, sometimes in politics, you can't say everything you know. I couldn't give my enemies the ammunition to use against me. Now, he didn't put it in quite these terms, but what he meant was, if I say we're going to war, then I'm not going to get elected. And Roosevelt, like very many other people who become president, and it's not just American presidents, was convinced that the safety of the country, the future of the country, depended on his political success. So he had come to identify his reelection with the safety and security of the United States.
Right. Convenient.
So what turns this on a dime? The thing that springs to my mind is Pearl Harbor.
That's it. I mean, what finally ends the debate is Pearl Harbor. Because the position of the America First Committee, it's one committee among others that was opposed to the war. As long as the United States is not at war, then this is a perfectly legitimate, perfectly constitutional position to take. You're not being disloyal, you're not being treasonous or anything to say we shouldn't go to war. It's an open question. But the question is closed when Japan attacks the United States at Pearl Harbor. Then the United States is at war. But the United States is not at war against Germany, whereas 98% of the debate was whether the United States was going to go to war against Germany. And very little attention was paid to what was going on in Asia. So there was this 72-hour period between the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor and finally Hitler declares war, Germany declares war against the United States. And that ends the debate finally. And it's important to note that Lindbergh, who had opposed the war, as soon as war is upon the United States, volunteers to rejoin the military.
Oh, interesting.
Now, Roosevelt's not going to let him in because the last thing Roosevelt wants is for his principal opponent to go off and become a military hero.
Over the course of writing this book, were you tempted to juxtaposition the debate with contemporary American politics? Obviously, America First is a phrase that President-elect Trump has used at various points of his political career. Do you see parallels with today? Do you see parallels with either the debate or the circumstances?
I'll put it this way. I don't write this in the book because I immodestly hope this book will have a shelf life. And so I hope the readers can pick up the book 40 years from now, regardless of what happens now. And so I deal with just up to before the present. But it's striking that the election campaign of 2024 was the first one in which Americans had a relatively clear decision regarding what America's role in the world should be. The debate between Roosevelt and Lindbergh was partly about should the United States go to war against Germany. But in a larger sense, it was what should America's position in the world be? Roosevelt taking the position that the United States must become the leader of the world. And Lindbergh saying, no, we shouldn't. If we do that, it will get us into conflicts that aren't ours, and it will undermine the American experiment of self-government at home. We will become a different country than we have been, and then we ought to be. So that was the underlying premise. And when Pearl Harbor happened and the United States was in the war, the Roosevelt side of that argument won. And it went essentially unchallenged for 80 years. There was a brief moment after the Vietnam War when some Americans said, you know, we don't need to get involved in these wars like in Vietnam. But no one at that point was questioning America's commitment to Europe, for example. But then in Donald Trump's first term, he began to question. The president of the United States is raising questions about America's continued commitment to Europe, because this was the center of the debate in the 1930s to 1940s. And Trump is saying, well, okay, we're not going to defend members of NATO who haven't paid up, who haven't, you know, built up their defenses. So in 2024, there was this fairly clear, maybe partly implicit distinction between Donald Trump, who is on record as saying he's not as committed to American leadership in the world on the terms in which it's been exercised for the previous 80 years, and Kamala Harris, who basically endorsed the Biden position. And the clearest example of this was American support for Ukraine and Ukraine's war against Russia, taking the position that Joe Biden has taken, still takes, that American security depends on the victory of Ukraine in its war against Russia, because if Russia wins, then aggression will expand and eventually the United States will have to fight somewhere else. Yes. Donald Trump challenged the premise, and Donald Trump won in 2024. What is this going to mean for American foreign policy in the next 4 years and beyond that? It certainly does, I think, make the debate of that earlier time more salient for today.
Studying World War II as a high school student, as an undergraduate, the isolationist position had this pejorative sense to it, and also just had this sense of, you know, being antiquated or naive or defeatist. That consensus seems to have broken down the last decade. What is it about the America First argument that's changed since Lindbergh's day that sort of brought it back to a place of respectability?
Well, I should start by saying that in a lot of circles among the people who make and do foreign policy, I'm not sure that America First has become respectable, at least no more respectable than Donald Trump has become respectable.
Yeah.
So maybe in position of influence, but it's still, isolation is still a pejorative term. I would say the biggest difference between the debate then and the debate now is the debate back then, what's called America First, the anti-interventionist position, that was the norm. That was the baseline from which the interventionists under Franklin Roosevelt had to move forward. They changed the baseline. So the baseline has been intervention, has been American commitment, American involvement in the affairs of the world. So that really from 1945 until almost today, hardly a conflict could break out anywhere without people in Washington saying, well, what does this mean for us? Which side do we need to take? And so on. And so the America Firsters today, assuming that they follow through on what they've been talking about, they have to change the status quo. The America Firsters back in the late 1930s, they were trying to defend the status quo. So they lost in their defense then. Today, it is the interventionist position that is the status quo. And the America Firsters, they have to win the debate. They have to change the terms. They have to change the status quo.
I think one difference you've also touched on elsewhere is faith in government. Roosevelt believes, he's obviously a great believer in government, believes the government can fix the depression, and then sort of applies that faith in government, which is not there in the 1920s, to foreign policy. American faith in government today seems shot to pieces sometimes.
Well, so I would say that in some respects, this confirms much of Lindbergh's argument. So American faith in government, it was strong in some quarters by the end of the 1930s, as a result of the New Deal, but it really became strong. It really became entrenched in the American consciousness generally by America's victory in World War II, because the United States takes on the world and America wins. And so in 1945, it was possible for Americans to think our government can do anything. It can do anything in the world, and we'll extrapolate backwards, it means it can do anything at home. And so the rise of sort of the modern, the really modern welfare state, the Great Society, all the new programs of the 1950s, 1960s, even in the 1970s, this is a consequence of that, of this implicit faith in government. And again, the biggest test of American government was World War II. We beat the fascists. But government can't fix everything, and problems arise, and there has never been any single victory in American history since World War II that even approached World War II in impressing Americans with what government can do. And so in politics is always, what have you done for me lately? And that lately now is 80 years old, nearly. Franklin Roosevelt was saying in the early 1940s, the United States should be the leader of the world and it can do a good job at it. In 1945, that position was unchallengeable. By 2016, again by 2024, that position's pretty challengeable. And so it makes it possible for this, we'll call it the America First attitude toward foreign policy, to gain a certain degree of respectability and to win the White House.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
15-Minute History is produced at the University of Texas at Austin in partnership with Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts. It is recorded at the Lates Development Studio. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on social media, and visit our website for more information and resources. See y'all next week.